Hey, it's Hannah Baba, host of Cross Current. Just a couple of times a year, we ask for your support, and now's the time to do that. Make sure to contribute today to our fall membership campaign. Keep us strong. If you want to contribute, go to KALW.org and click donate. And thank you.
KALW.
What was interesting during my conversations with residents, the common issue was public safety.
The redistricting of Oakland's District 5 last year has shifted and reshaped the community's priorities.
Longtime business owners in Fruitvale butting heads with other organizations who don't want more police presence in the neighborhood, and the business owner saying, no, yes, we do, please bring more police presence.
Today, what residents are thinking about crime rates and how that relates to the recall of Oakland Mayor Sheng Tao. Then we explore the personal impacts of climate change.
She is heartbroken, downtrodden, grief-stricken. They have even a word for it now, eco-grief.
The next episode of Book It. I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. In this year's election, Oakland has four districts with open city council seats. To better understand what residents care most about, we've been speaking with reporters from the Oakland side who are covering the district races. KALW executive producer Ben Trefney spoke with arts, culture, and community reporter Azucena Racia about what's most pressing for the people living in District 5.
District 5 is a very diverse and heavily populated area in Oakland. Can you describe what this district is like? Like, so people from around the Bay Area can get a sense of where we're at?
Yeah, well, District 5 includes, it's such a broad area of Oakland. The Fruitvale District is the most dense area of the district. Then you have Jingletown, which is artists. There's a lot of like artists and art. Communities, galleries, Fruitvale, as I mentioned earlier. And there's little pockets of the district as well that are more residential. A lot of longtime homeowners, longtime renters. And in recent years, of course, more transplants who have found, you know, downtown, or North Oakland and other areas of the city too expensive to live, and finding that the area, the pockets in District 5, are a little more accessible and affordable. What's interesting about Fruitvale, it's always been Latino populated, right? For the past, you know, since the 60s or so. But what we're starting to see in the past 10 years is an influx of immigrants from Guatemala coming in and building community in Fruitvale. So to where 20 years prior, you would see more Mexicans, Salvadorian folk living there. Now, the predominantly groups is Guatemalan folks. And a lot of them don't speak Spanish or English. They speak Mom. Mm. So you have that added, you know, another language that the people know, but others in the district don't know. So yeah, it's a really interesting mix of cultures. And it's interesting to see the changes in the landscape and the demographics in the past 10 years.
Well, with such a large Mom-speaking population, are there services provided for them in that language?
There aren't that many, but there are certainly groups, organizations, nonprofits that have devoted their time to make sure that they have Mom speakers.
So last year, there was some redistricting in this area, and there was redistricting of Glenview, which is a neighborhood of single-family homes. How did that impact District 5?
Yeah, you know, the redistricting map, there were a lot of folks in Oakland who were not satisfied. I mean, there were several versions of the map. The final map, folks were just discontent, because what happened with District 5 is that you remove this area of Glenview, right, which is the population is higher income than the rest of the district. So you took that away. And for folks, it felt like it was redlined in a way, like the district was redlined. And now you sort of only have the district with a higher population of like Black and brown folk, and really all the richer, higher income areas were more towards obviously District 6 and District 4.
So there are many different communities in District 5. Can you compare and contrast some of the different issues that the communities here face?
You know, what was interesting during my conversations with residents throughout the district, the common issue was public safety. So yeah, the conversation was, we want to find better ways, holistic approach to curbing crime. But also what people talked about was crime is bigger than just crime itself, right? There are other rooted issues like lack of housing, you know, lack of basic services, not having things for youth in Oakland to do, but also what are we doing to curb the systematic issues behind why crime ends up happening. On the flip side, you have business owners in Fruitvale who, you know, obviously directly targeted by crime. And they have an interesting approach to where they want more police presence. For them, they feel like, you know, a heftier police presence will in turn help lower crime. So you have this sort of like clash, right? And there are also organizations in Fruitvale who are sort of anti-police and more, let's try to find other holistic approaches to curbing crime. So you have this like butting heads of longtime business owners in Fruitvale, butting heads with other organizations who don't want more police presence in the neighborhood, and the business owners saying, no, yes, we do, please bring more police presence. But yeah, the overall issue for sure with everyone that I talked to was public safety.
Did you get a sense of where people stood in District 5 on which way they wanted to go in order to ensure the future and presence of public safety?
Business owners that I talked to certainly want more police presence. They want, you know, foot patrols. They want to see more engagement from the Oakland Police Department, you know, community engagement with business owners. On the flip side, obviously, then residents wanted other approaches. Folks mentioned the ceasefire program, but also folks mentioned the effects of the pandemic are still resonating in the district and throughout Oakland, really, you know, 4 years later. So it was a combination of, again, business owners wanting more police presence and residents wanting city council members to fund other programs, right? So yeah, I think the District 5, because it is one of those low voting districts, it's the underdog and you know, people are sleeping on that district, but there's folks that are really passionate about the issues in the district, folks that are building community and have built community for a really, really long time.
That was Azucena Racia, arts, culture, and community reporter with the Oakland Side, speaking with KALW executive producer Ben Trefney. Find all our election coverage at kalw.org/2024elections. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Now it's time to settle in with a good read. Book It is our author interview series hosted by KALW's Angie Coy Rowe. This week, Nina Schuyler discusses her debut book, In This Ravishing World. Here's Angie.
Thanks, Anna. Now, this is Fiction Today with a deep shot of reality. Bay Area writer Nina Schuyler tells how climate change impacts a handful of people in their lives separately and together. Her short story collection, In This Ravishing World, brings us a jaded former environmental activist, her daughter, optimistically trying to get pregnant in the face of a dire future, a young boy from a poorer San Francisco neighborhood running at night to the beautiful greenery of the richer ones, and nature herself, a cognizant being who heads to the beach sometimes to calm her frayed nerves. The book has won the W.S. Porter Prize for Short Story Collections and the PRISM Prize for Climate Literature. Nina Schuyler graduated from Stanford, UC Law, and San Francisco State University. She teaches creative writing at Stanford Continuing Studies, the Writing Salon, and at Book Passage. We talked first about the risk of writing about climate change. Some potential readers are plain worn out on the topic. So what moved her to go there?
Several things. I have children, so I kept thinking of the future. And if they turn to me ever and ask, Mom, what did you do What did you do at that crucial point as we tipped closer and closer to the path of no return? And I wanted an answer. And then on another occasion, I took my son out during one of the many wildfires, and the air was filled with smoke, and he went to play basketball. He loves basketball. So this was before the pandemic, and I rounded up a N95 mask, which was hard to do, and I took him out, and he lasted for about 15 minutes. That was it. And he was coughing. He has asthma as well. So it was, what am I going to do? Another thing is my scientist friends keep saying that facts aren't working. Mm-hmm. Just pummeling the people, audience, with more facts of what's happening to the earth aren't working. We need stories. So that was something I could do. And you're right, it's brave, you know, because we're taught, and I am a creative writing teacher, not to do kind of pedantic or issue-driven stories.
Yes.
So it's very challenging to come up with the way to do it that isn't hitting someone over the head with it.
What makes your book work, I think, what gets people over that hump, it's the poetry of the words. It's a fiction book that stands on its own merits, even if you take climate change out of the equation. The other thing I thought was brave, you went to a woman, Eleanor, in your first story, who's had it, and she was once optimistic, and now she's not. And this is the first person we meet, and we're going to hang on and read the rest of the book. I did hang on, and there are other voices, but again, that's a brave step to say, let's start with someone who's fed up to hear with it all.
Yeah. I mean, she is grief-stricken. She has worked her whole life to prevent what's happening now. She's an environmental economist. She's 70, and I love her. I love her. But she is heartbroken, downtrodden, grief-stricken. You know, they have even a word for it now, eco-grief.
Yes.
It's a syndrome. I think everybody feels it if they pay attention to it, like what's happening to the planet. Well, she feels it immensely. And it is brave, but I have many friends that are ecologists or scientists that are feeling this level of despair. So I wanted to start with that. And in some ways, I'm preaching to the choir, but maybe the choir needs being preached to, meaning you believe in climate change, you want something to change. It's hard to face it. It's terrifying. But you need something. You need a book that can invite you in. It's like, I identify with that. Mm-hmm. I can identify with this grief. And I love the planet. I love Earth and what's happening to it.
Yeah. Although when we meet her, she has been discouraged by so much of her work being undone. She hasn't sat and done nothing. She has worked with corporations. She's gotten them to stop building in the forest. She's gotten them to clean the water up, and she's seen that work undone. Any of us who might be activists who are seeing both the victories and the defeats, what do you do with the defeats?
Well, you keep looking. I subscribe to many positive environmental newsletters so that you balance it out, because there are triumphs, there are successes. And I've really thought about this because I belong to a group of academics that are trying to really think and reflect, how do you teach about climate change in the classroom? Mm-hmm. How do you bring climate fiction in? And there's a whole movement, as I see it, of just tell it like it is. Just go ahead and pummel everyone over the head with it. And I don't agree with it. I think the human spirit needs hope. And it is true that there's something that can be done. So that was a balancing act that I do, is, you know, offset the bad news with the good news. And in the book, I really try to keep hope alive and give incidents where there's so much beauty in the world still, mm-hmm. that there's moments, you know, you're reading and then you can luxuriate in the trees or go to the ocean. Nature loves to go to the ocean because of the waves.
I love that, by the way.
So nature will wander down there when it's feeling a little blue and just listen and watch the birds. And that's what I do, is head out into nature to revive the spirit or soul, whatever you want to call it, the engine for hope, and keep going.
Yeah. There's actually this book called The Future We Choose. And of all people, you're familiar. It's the people who put together the two primary people behind the Climate Alliance, the International Climate Alliance. They are optimistic. They don't believe for a moment that we're not facing consequences. They're not saying that. They're saying, here are these practical and still wonderful ways that we can live with that. I think those voices don't get through very much.
I agree. I mean, I think the news loves the terrifying or the catastrophic or the bad news, because that's conflict, versus here's some good news.
Right.
News is not driven, I was once a journalist, is not driven by, let me tell you a good story. You know, everybody's happy. You know,
one lovely thing about podcasts, we've got the storytellers out there all of a sudden, which is great, yeah. All these different voices. And I know there are podcasts that focus on climate, and they're not relentless. They're not weeping and wailing. They're not gnashing of teeth. They're looking practically, including at what's going well. I do want to go back to Eleanor, because Eleanor is contrasted with her sister, from whom she's been estranged. And I find Hazel to be an interesting person in that you have made her a nun. She made herself a nun. And she has unending optimism that is biblically based. Her optimism comes from her religion, which Eleanor and Eleanor's family don't necessarily buy into. Can you talk about, as an author, the purpose of bringing her in there and the purpose of her optimism?
Yes. So I was really captivated by that word dominion in the Bible, that humanity has dominion over every other being, every other non-human. And that kind of set up a possible stage. At least we took the step in that direction of human exceptionalism and turning everything into a resource. If we dominion, dominate, those are very similar terms. Now many churches today have moved to become stewards, and that's another term that's out there, right? To become stewards of nature. Now, the underlying belief of all that is that this is God's creation. And is he really going to let it vanish and be destroyed? So there's a kernel of hope in that thinking, I find, in the biblical thinking, that this can't possibly happen. It may be delusional a little bit to think that, you know, mankind will be prevented from doing this, but I think there's something about viewing the world as the creation of God, and it's a jewel, it's precious. So how could it possibly disappear? How could it possibly be destroyed? So Hazel is in that, her sister is in that world, in that belief system. And Eleanor is in the science and economics, a very different way of viewing the world.
Yeah.
So they cannot meet eye to eye. And at some point, you know, Eleanor accuses Hazel of helping contribute to where we are now. And then Hazel turns that right back around and said, well, you know, you participated in capitalism. You were part of it, trying to convince the companies to do the right thing, and sometimes they did and sometimes they didn't. But isn't this a system that is counter to sustainability on the earth?
That's a tension that's been out there for a long time, is how much one in the nature and environmental movements wants to engage at all with the commercial for-profit, the capitalism. And I remember a case, forgive me for not remembering the specific name of the organization involved, but a long-established environmental organization. And one of their key figures went to work in the capitalist world. And there was a great fluff-up about how dishonest it was. And he said, you got to get somebody in there. You got to get someone to work on, if you want to put it that way, that side, or we're not getting anywhere.
That's right. I mean, you can't just say, let's get rid of capitalism. If anything, it's going to be regulation. We've seen that through the EPA, right? Okay, you cannot release that level of CO2. So we didn't, when before we had those regulations, it was a lot more polluted in Los Angeles, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we need to, and Eleanor saw that we need to have some kind of conversation, that the externalized costs of corporations, pollution, you know, toxicity in the water, you know, soil contamination, those are considered externalized costs. They need to be internalized or stopped. So that is a path. I mean, it's a legitimate path, in my view. I mean, capitalism isn't going away. If anything, it's going to be, and it is in this country, tailored and, you know, customized so that we have a planet that's habitable.
Yeah, yeah. One of the things I wonder about older people conversing with younger people and conveying the urgency. Obviously, they're seeing it from a whole different perspective than we did growing up. But one thing that boomers and slightly younger have in common is we saw Lake Erie on fire. We saw the alleged Indian cry. Of course, we found out he was Italian later, but the tear rolling down his cheek when he saw what was happening to his land. And we saw, you know, suds and bubbles on what was allegedly fresh water because so much junk was being dumped in there. I wonder how much of that is lost. I saw you talking in an interview, and you were talking about the importance of the recording of whale songs and learning that whale songs were a music of their own source, and that made them of more urgency to people to save them because they had that common ground. Yeah. We make music, the whales make music. But how many people know that record amongst the very young? And I wonder about passing along that generational knowledge.
I love that. I love that you're bringing that up because I grew up with that record playing. My mom went out and bought it, and it was this haunting whale song throughout the house. And it was just so eerie and ghostly and mesmerizing, yeah. All of it. Like, I can't believe they're doing this, that whales are actually singing. Now, there was an intentional use of that word singing, right. The songs of the humpback whale versus sounds or rhythmic something, you know, vibrations under the water. So there was an appeal. The scientists that tracked all the and recorded all the sounds, it was an appeal to the humans or humanity to pay attention to the whales and make some human kind of connection, right. Using that term. And bringing this up, it makes me want to go out and buy the record and or something and play it for him.
Yeah. Bring a little bit of that knowledge.
But I will say, like, my son, again, he's 13, so they've been raised on recycling. You know, at schools, there's where do you put your garbage? There's always bins, so he's really aware of that at home. No plastic. Like, do we have to get the plastic thing? So these things that have been embedded in or interwoven in the education system are changing this generation.
That's Angie Coiro with our featured series, Book It. Her guest this week was Nina Schuyler, author of the new book, In This Ravishing World, a collection of interconnected short stories about the personal impacts of climate change. Read all about it at kalw.org/crosscurrents. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.